Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Isaiah chapter 31. I will entitle this chapter, Woe to Those Who Go Down to Egypt. This is a continuation of the last chapter, chapter 30, which I entitled, Do Not Go Down to Egypt. The setting of this chapter is during the times of King Hezekiah, when Sennacherib of Assyria is running his armies all over Judah and finally besieged Jerusalem in 701. Short chapter today, so this should go quickly. We start in Isaiah 31, verses 1 through 3. Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help, Isaiah begins, who rely on horses, who trust in the multitude of their chariots and in the great strength of their horsemen, but do not look to the Holy One of Israel or seek help from the Lord. Yet he too is wise and can bring disaster. He does not take back his words. He will rise up against the house of the wicked, against those who help evildoers. But the Egyptians are men and not God. Their horses are flesh and not spirit. When the Lord stretches out his hand, he who helps will stumble. He who is helped will fall. Both will perish together. In verse 1, Isaiah says, Woe to those who go down to Egypt. Of course, going from Jerusalem anywhere in the world is going down. That's the way things were. Jerusalem was up in the air, sort of on a mountain. Isaiah is saying, Woe to those who go down to Egypt. This was contrary, going down to Egypt was contrary to the express command of God. We read in the last chapter, Isaiah 30, verses 2 through 3, They set out to go down to Egypt without asking my advice, in order to seek shelter under Pharaoh's protection and take refuge in Egypt's shadow. But Pharaoh's protection will become your shame, and refuge in Egypt's shadow your disgrace. So, relying on Egypt is going to result in shame and disgrace for Israel. Isaiah has already told them that, but he wants to reinforce his strictures here in chapter 31. Also in chapter 30, verse 7, Isaiah said, Egypt's help is completely worthless. Therefore, I call her Rahab who just sits. That's the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. The NIV has Rahab the do-nothing. The people who want Hezekiah to go to Egypt for help want to rely on the horses of Egypt. Isaiah says that in verse 1. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says of this in there, referring to the Egyptians, in the Egyptian level and fertile plains, horses could easily be used and fed. In hilly Palestine, horses were not so easily had or available. The Jews were therefore the more eager to get Egyptian chariots as allies against the Assyrian cavalry. Remember, Assyria is to the northeast of Israel, Egypt is to the southwest, and right in the middle is Judah, like a piece of ham in a ham sandwich. And so it was logical militarily to look to the Egyptians for help, but God knew better, and he was speaking to the people through Isaiah. Now, Egyptians had horses because land was flat in Egypt, easy to feed and raise horses, not so in Palestine, which was hilly. And so the Jews were tempted to look down to the Egyptians to buy horses down there. In fact, to give you an idea of horses in Egypt, let's look at Exodus 14:9. The Egyptians are chasing the Israelites on the Exodus. We read in Exodus 14:9, The Egyptians, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots, his horsemen and his army chased after the Jews and caught up with them. This was right before the Jews entered the Red Sea. They were chased by horses. 1 Kings 10:28, Solomon's horses were imported from Egypt and Kueh. Kueh is probably Cilicia, the area around the northeastern corner of the Mediterranean Sea where Tarsus was, where Paul was from. Solomon's horses were imported from Egypt. So we see that Isaiah is talking about something that the Jews were quite familiar with, the horses of Egypt. But don't trust in them. Don't trust in their strength. Not only the horses should they not trust in, but they should not trust in the multitude of the Egyptians' chariots, their military strength, or the great strength of their horsemen. How strong are the Egyptians on top of the horses? None of it. But they should look to the Holy One of Israel, i.e. Yahweh. They should seek help from God. Verse 2, Yet he, that's Yahweh, is wise and can bring disaster. In other words, God's wisdom is greater than the strength of the Egyptian chariots and horses, and God can bring disasters, and he does not take back his words. Now, why is God said to be wise too? Well, the Israelites thought the Egyptians were wise, as John Gill says. The Egyptians were, quote, thought to be a wise and political people, and wiser than themselves, wiser than the Israelites, who imagined that they, the Egyptians, acted a prudent part in applying to them. Who imagined that they, the Jews, acted a prudent part in applying to the Egyptians. Of course, the Egyptians were wise. They had a civilization, 3000 BC at least, probably before that, oldest civilization in the world. I know the Chinese claim otherwise. Who knows? But the Egyptians were famous for their wisdom. But Isaiah says, hey, Yahweh too is wise, and he can bring disaster on the Assyrians. You don't need the Egyptians to do it. And he doesn't take back his words. That means when he speaks, that's it. His word is reliable. He will rise up against the house of the wicked, against those who help evildoers. Now, who is the house of the wicked? I suspect it's noble families in Judah who are advocating this Egyptian alliance. Noble families who are helping other evildoers in Judah who are trying to perpetrate this Egyptian alliance. In verse 3, Isaiah says, but the Egyptians are men and not God. In other words, God is wise. He can bring disaster. He's strong. But the Egyptians are merely men. Their horses are flesh, merely flesh, and they're not spirit. And that word spirit there, of course, means they don't have the power of God who is spirit. Their horses are flesh. Well, of course, their horses are flesh, but what Isaiah means is they're weak. Flesh is weak compared with the spiritual power of God. When the Lord stretches out his hand, he who helps will stumble. The one who helps, of course, is Egypt. They will stumble. They will fail. He who is helped, that's Israel. They will fall. Both will perish together. So Isaiah is saying, don't go down to Egypt. You're going to lose. We go now to Isaiah 31, verses 4 through 7. Isaiah continues, this is what the Lord says to me. Now, from here on till the end of verse 5, we have Yahweh speaking through Isaiah. As a lion growls, a great lion over his prey, and though a whole band of shepherds is called together against him, he is not frightened by their shouts. The lion is not frightened by the shouts of the shepherds, or disturbed by their clamor. The lion is not disturbed by the clamor of the shepherds. So the Lord Almighty will come down to do battle on Mount Zion and on its heights. God's coming like a lion, and he's not scared. Like birds hovering overhead, the Lord Almighty will shield Jerusalem. He will shield it and deliver it. He will pass over it and will rescue it. Return to him you have so greatly revolted against, O Israelites. For in that day every one of you will reject the idols of silver and gold your sinful hands have made. Now notice here, Isaiah is calling the people of Judah sinful, people who have rebelled against God, and yet Jerusalem's going to be saved. Once again, there's so much mercy mixed in with the hellfire and damnation prophecies of Isaiah. So God is coming like a lion, unafraid lion. No matter how much the shepherds are screaming against the lion, no matter how much the Assyrians are screaming against God, God's going to come down. He's going to do battle on Mount Zion against the Assyrian army. And of course, we know the Assyrian army was destroyed by the angel of the Lord in 701 BC when a plague apparently swept through the whole Assyrian army and it retreated on back to Nineveh in Assyria. And so this is what's being described here in verse 5. Like birds hovering overhead, the Lord Almighty will shield Jerusalem. Here's what Gill says about these birds. Speed and swiftness in the deliverance of his people. As birds in the air at a distance, especially the eagle, have their eye upon their nest and their young ones in them, and when in danger fly to their assistance and hover over them and about them to keep off those that would hurt them or carry them away, so the Lord on high sees his people when in distress and hastens to help them and does surround, protect, and defend them. Thus the Lord did when Sennacherib with his army besieged Jerusalem, who boasted with respect to other nations that he had found as a nest the riches of the people, and that there was none that moved the wing against him. In other words, God is circling overhead, watching out for the people of Jerusalem. God will pass over Jerusalem and will rescue it. Now the NIV translation has Passover in quotation marks. Why? Well, because this is the only use of the Hebrew word Pesach in the Hebrew scriptures, except for Exodus 12, where it refers to the Passover. So Pesach is the Passover. And so Passover is put in quotes here. He will pass over it and will rescue it. The allusion, of course, is to the times when Israel was in slavery in Egypt. And on the night of the Passover, the Israelites put blood on the lintels of their doorways, and the angel of death passed over the houses of the Israelites, and the Israelites were saved and rescued. And so this is the same thing here. God is going to pass over Jerusalem and save it. Now, the analogy is not perfectly tight because it was an angel of death passing over the Israelites in the time of the Exodus, and here it's God passing over Jerusalem to save it. But the analogy doesn't have to be that tight. The point is God will deliver his people just as he delivered them on the Exodus. It's kind of interesting. The NIV is the only one of the many translations that I look at that puts Passover in quotation marks. And in fact, most of the translations say something like protect. So the English translation in the NIV actually brings forth that reference to Passover. I like that. Now in verse 7, Isaiah says, in that day, that's the day of deliverance from Sennacherib, every one of you will reject the idols of silver and gold that your sinful hands have made. As John Gill says, the people of Judah threw their idols away after Sennacherib was beaten. This was under good King Hezekiah, who turned away from idolatry after that defeat of Sennacherib. We read this in 2 Kings 18:4. He, that's Hezekiah, removed the high places, shattered the sacred pillars, and cut down the Asherah. The Asherah, the wooden poles dedicated to Astarte, the fertility goddess who came from the area of Tyre. Hezekiah broke into pieces the bronze snake that Moses made, for the Israelites burned incense to it up to that time. I just love that. Moses has a bronze snake, which is a type of Christ taking on the sins of the world. It took on the burning spider bites or whatever it was the Israelites had that were bothering them, and they were healed by that snake, a symbol of Christ, and the Jews turned it into an idol. They would turn anything into an idol. The Israelites burned incense to it up to that time, but Hezekiah broke the old bronze snake, which Moses had called Nehushtan. Hezekiah broke it to pieces. 2 Chronicles 29:16, we read this. The priest went to the entrance of the Lord's temple to cleanse it. They took all the unclean things they found in the Lord's sanctuary to the courtyard of the Lord's temple. Then the Levites received them and took them outside to the Kidron Valley. So you wonder, what in the world, what kind of idols had the Jews put into the very temple of Yahweh? They ended up getting burned in the Kidron Valley because of Hezekiah. 2 Chronicles 31:1. When all this was completed, all Israel who had attended went out to the cities of Judah and broke up the sacred pillars, chopped down the Asherah poles, and tore down the high places and altars throughout Judah and Benjamin, as well as in Ephraim and Manasseh to the last one. Then all the Israelites returned to their cities, each to his own possession. Now Isaiah had promised this destruction of the idols in the previous chapter, chapter 30, verse 22. Then you will defile your silver-plated idols and your gold-plated images. You will throw them away like menstrual cloths, kotex, and call them filth. So the idols were likened unto dirty kotexes. So this is pretty cool. Great victory for God and that righteous band of people who supported him. Probably not a very big band, but the people who followed Isaiah. The idols are torn down. Of course, it didn't last. We know that. They weren't totally destroyed until the Jews went on their Babylonian exile a little over a century later. But at least temporarily, they had some relief from their idolatry because of Hezekiah's miraculous deliverance from Sennacherib. And when we get to the chapter that describes this invasion by Sennacherib, we will see that Jerusalem was in dire straits. It's a miracle they didn't get totally destroyed. I think I would have given up idolatry too after I saw that. We go now to verses 8 and 9 of Isaiah 31, and we will be finished with this chapter. Yahweh is still speaking. Assyria will fall by a sword that is not of man, a sword not of mortals, will devour them. They will flee before the sword, and their young men will be put to forced labor. Their stronghold will fall because of terror. At sight of the battle standard, their commanders will panic, declares the Lord, whose fire is in Zion, whose furnace is in Jerusalem. Now again, this is the destruction of Sennacherib's army by that plague that happened in one night, as the army was camped in the Valley of Hinnom, surrounding Jerusalem. There are a couple of references in these two verses which might be problematic. So we'll look at that now. First of all, we see that a sword devoured the army of Assyria. And this sword is said to be, in verse 8, not of mortals. That's because God did it. An angel, actually, of God destroyed Sennacherib's army, so that was not a mortal defeat for the army. It was not a typical military defeat. Now, when it says Assyria will fall by the sword, it means the Assyrian army, of course, not the whole nation. Now, let's look at this sword that is not of man. Here's some options. Option number one, this is a sword which would be held in the hand of the angel of the Lord. According to this option, the angel actually appeared in some kind of form that the Assyrians could see. And when Sennacherib saw it, as well as the fact that a lot of people in his army were killed by that plague, he fled from the sword. We read that, by the way, in 2 Kings 19:36. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, broke camp and left. He returned home and lived in Nineveh. Well, that's option number one. It's a sword that was actually wielded by the angel that Sennacherib actually saw. Option number two, in verse 8, Assyria will fall by a sword. That's the NIV translation. Well, Assyria can be translated as the Assyrian will fall by a sword. Now, the Assyrian, of course, could mean the Assyrian army, but it could also mean that it's referring to the chief Assyrian, namely Sennacherib. He did fall by a sword. He was slain by his own sons in 681 BC in a famous story in Assyrian history. And so we would read, the Assyrian will fall by a sword. But that seems a little bit out of context because the whole story here is about the invasion of Judah and the siege of Jerusalem. So I'm not going to hold to that option. By the way, most translations don't translate it like NIV. Most translations translate it as Assyrian, not Assyria. The Assyrian, the ASV, the NASB, the RSV, the ESV, and the King James Version of 1611. But, like I say, even if it's the Assyrian, that could still refer to the camp of the Assyrians that got wiped out by that plague. Now, Albert Barnes and Jameson Fawcett Brown say that the sword here is not a literal sword, but the word is used metaphorically. It is the unseen sword of God, as Jameson Fawcett Brown put it. And Barnes says it metaphorically means that complete destruction would come upon Assyria. I think that Barnes and Jameson Fawcett Brown have got the answer. This is a metaphorical use. A sword kills people, and a lot of people died. Of course, it wasn't the Jews who slew with literal swords the army of the Assyrians. It was the sword of the Lord, and that was not a literal sword. Now, the Assyrians are also said in verse 8 to be put to forced labor. Now, there's a problem if you take that literally. When were the Assyrians subjected to forced labor? Now, interestingly enough, none of my many commentaries dealt with this issue, so I'm just going to give you my solution. Forced labor is tributary. Some translations translate it that way. Assyria became tributary to Babylonia after 609 BC, the Battle of Phoran, when Assyria finally left history, when the Babylonians whopped them. And then, of course, it's reasonable to assume that the Babylonians subjected individual Assyrians to forced labor at that time. But again, the problem with that, it puts the forced labor at about 100 years after the siege of Jerusalem by Assyria. Sennacherib's siege of 701 BC and the fall of Assyria to Babylonia was 609 BC. That's almost 100 years later. So I think we are forced to take this reference to forced labor as metaphorical. They're going to get beaten by the sword, killed, and they're going to be enslaved because that's what happens to defeated armies. Now, of course, you could say that it wasn't the whole nation of Assyria that became tributary to Babylonia. They became a province, I guess, after the Babylonians beat them. Or it could refer to individual Assyrians, not the whole province of Assyria, but individual Assyrians who were subject to forced labor when the Babylonians beat them. But I think it's just much easier to say this is all metaphorical, referring to the defeat of Sennacherib in 701. His army will flee before the sword and be put to forced labor. That's what happens when armies are beaten in ancient warfare. Verse 9, there, that's the Assyrian army under Sennacherib, stronghold will fall because of terror. The NASB puts it, his rock will pass away because of panic, and his princes will be terrified at the standard. John Gill says, his mighty men, his men of valor, in whom he trusted and put his confidence, who were his strength, on which he depended, these, as many as were left of them, fled away. So the stronghold was the camp, the military camp, with all of the Assyrian generals that fell. It wasn't an actual fort up in a hill somewhere. The King James has a different translation. It says, and he shall pass over to his stronghold for fear. John Gill says, if you translate it that way, this is said of the king of Assyria departing in haste from the siege of Jerusalem to some stronghold in his own country, particularly his strong city Nineveh, for fear of the angel and destruction following him. He shall pass over to his stronghold. His stronghold would be Nineveh. But I don't think that's true. All the other translations have not that he will depart to his stronghold, but that his rock will pass away, his stronghold will pass away. That's how the ASV, the RSV, the ESV, and Green's literal translation has it. So the rock is Sennacherib's source of strength, his stronghold, his army. In verse 9, Isaiah says, at the sight of the battle standard, the Assyrian commanders will panic. The sight of what battle standard? Here's some options. John Gill says that this refers to any ensign or standard that the Assyrians saw. As soon as they saw a battle standard, even one of their own, they might suppose it to be a detachment of the Jews in pursuit of them. As soon as the Assyrians saw a battle flag, they might suppose it to be a detachment of Jews in pursuit of them, the Assyrians. The battle standard, option number 2, might refer to the standard erected by the angel in the air, if he did so. That's a little bit speculative. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that it's option number 3. The battle standard is the banner of Jehovah metaphorically protecting the Jews. In other words, there was no literal battle standard. It's just a metaphor referring to the fact that Yahweh is fighting for Israel. I think that's the proper solution. So God finishes his little speech here, declares the Lord, and then Isaiah says concerning the Lord, whose fire is in Zion. Zion, of course, is a synecdoche for Jerusalem, part for the whole. Zion is the city of David within Jerusalem, Mount Zion. And that Mount Zion stands for all of Jerusalem. God has a fire in Jerusalem. He has a furnace in Jerusalem. A couple of options as to what that fire is. A few options. Option number 1. This represents God's home, this fire does, because home is where the hearth is. I don't think that's the right answer. Option number 2, it refers to the altar of the Lord. On that bronze altar, fires were continually burning sacrifices. I suspect that's what Isaiah meant here when he talked about God's fire in Jerusalem. Could be the wrath of God, option number 3. But why would Isaiah be talking about judgment on Jerusalem when he just talked about deliverance from judgment on Jerusalem? That can't be it. Option number 4. The fire of God in Jerusalem stands for the fiery furnace awaiting those enemies of God who attack Jerusalem. Well, that might be, but I think it's talking about the fire on that bronze altar. Every morning and evening they had a morning and evening sacrifice. Fire's always there on that altar. And that's important to Yahweh. That's why Isaiah mentions it here. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished chapter 31 of Isaiah. And we are now prepared to go to Isaiah 32, which I will entitle, A King Will Reign in Righteousness. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.